This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, July 10, 2002, from the Chiapas Independent Media Center in Mexico. I'm Deepa Fernandez. The Senate confirms Yucca Mountain in Nevada as the site to store the nation's nuclear waste. As another young black man in Los Angeles is beaten by white police officers, the police brutality is caught on videotape and the family is filing federal civil rights charges. And we go to Ithaca, New York, in the third of our five-part special series looking at toxic waste dump sites that the Bush administration refuses to clean. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A conservative watchdog group has sued Vice President Dick Cheney and the Halliburton Company for their alleged fraudulent accounting practices. Gareth Schweitzer reports from D.C.
Judicial Watch, a conservative organization that led the movement to impeach President Clinton, is charging Vice President Dick Cheney and other company officers with hiding losses and misleading investors. The company is accused of overstating revenues by $445 million between 1999 and the end of 2001. Russell Verney, national advisor to Judicial Watch, says the civil suit filed today is to gain compensation for Halliburton's investors.
The suit is filed on behalf of shareholders to make them whole in the event that the accounting practices prove to be faulty at Halliburton and misled the shareholders to the value of the company.
Halliburton is also under investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission for overrunning costs on construction projects and for engaging in business with nations currently on the United States' watch list of terrorist nations. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said today that the suit is without merit. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
The United Nations Security Council openly debated today the peacekeeping mission in Bosnia, which is under threat due to a U.S. veto 10 days ago. Heather Risby reports from the U.N.
Today, country after country criticized the U.S. role in blocking a resolution on the extension of U.N. peacekeeping missions in Bosnia. Early last week, the U.S. had rejected the resolution after other members of the Security Council, including the United Kingdom and France, refused to accept the U.S. demand that its peacekeepers be protected from any possible prosecution by the International Criminal Court or the ICC. South African Ambassador Dumisani Khumalo said this action by one member of this council affects peace and stability in the entire Balkans and has implications for all UN peacekeeping operations throughout the world. But the US position remains unchanged. Members of the Security Council are now expected to have another round of consultations in order to make a final decision before midnight on Monday. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Risby at the UN.
The trial of the SOA 37, or those arrested for protesting at the formerly known School of the Americas, enters its third day today at a federal courthouse in Georgia. Amy Webb has the story from Columbus.
The 37 protesters are charged with criminal trespassing onto the Army base of Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia, where they were participating in the annual School of Americas protest last November, a protest that drew over 10,000 people calling for the closure of the notorious school. Recently renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, the school's 60,000 Latin American graduates have allegedly been involved in human rights abuses and atrocities since the school's founding in 1946. Training manuals for the school, released in 1996 under the Freedom of Information Act, advocated torture, extortion, murder, and the arrest of witnesses' family members as a means of interrogation. The trial continues for the remaining eight who have all pled not guilty and refused to stipulate to any facts. Sentences, the maximum of which would be 6 months in federal prison and up to $5,000 in fines, will be announced when all trials have been completed later this week. 71 people have served a total of over 40 years in prison for protesting the School of the Americas, including an 88-year-old Franciscan nun who was recently released from her 6-month prison sentence. This is Amy Webb reporting from Columbus, Georgia for Free Speech Radio News.
Angry local women in the Nigerian Niger Delta region have taken over oil installation facilities of Chevron Texaco. The women say the U.S.-owned corporation has done nothing to help their standard of living, but has done plenty of damage. Sam Olakoya reports from Lagos.
they stormed the facility on Monday with household items, including kitchenwares, and vowed not to return to their homes until their demands for the provision of social amenities like water and electricity are met. A woman activist, Mrs. Anunu Uwawa, who led the protesting women, said in the last 32 years that Chevron has operated in the area, the company never did anything tangible to improve their standard of living. In the last 40 years, the Nigerian government and Western multinational oil companies have been sharing the oil revenue to the exclusion of local communities who suffer serious environmental impacts. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
There is outrage in communities of color around the country as yet another white police officer in the Los Angeles town of Inglewood was caught on video camera beating a young black man he was arresting. The videotape was taken by a tourist on Saturday at a motel across the street from the gas station where the arrest took place. It shows the teen hoisted to his feet by Officer Morse and slammed onto the trunk of a police car. The officer then puts a hand on the back of the teenager's neck, slugs him with his other hand, and then appears to choke him. The FBI yesterday began investigating the videotaped beating of Donovan Jackson, and the city's mayor demanded that the officer face assault, battery, and child abuse charges without further delay. This is today the family of Donovan Jackson announced their filing a federal civil rights lawsuit less than a week after the cadre of white Inglewood police officers were caught on tape beating the black 16-year-old. Jackson's attorney, John Sweeney.
Even though something like this goes on, it can still happen in our country some 50 years after Brown versus Board of Education, it'd be 50 years in 2 years, we want everyone to know that we can immediately file a claim, file a lawsuit in federal court to seek redress and to seek recompense for the damages done to our clients.
And we go to Los Angeles now to Peter Seymour, who has more on the story.
This is police abuse and racial profiling, and we want the help of the federal government. If they can fight terrorism across the country, then let's fight urban terrorism right here in America.
Najee Ali of the Project for Islamic Hope was the first of a dozen speakers outside the Inglewood Civic Center. Ali led the swarm of protesters expressing their outrage at the police department's investigation over the beating of 16-year-old Donovan Jackson. Though Officer Jeremy Morse has been suspended, with pay, for beating the minor, the demonstrators want him fired. Mayor Roosevelt Dorn, a former prosecutor and judge, echoed similar sentiments.
My recommendation is that this officer be suspended without pay. That's number one, that the investigation be completed, and upon the completion of the investigation, it is my opinion that he should be fired.
More people delved into Morse's background today and revealed their findings. Jackson's attorney, Joe Hopkins, told NBC's Today Show that this was not the first time Morse beat an African-American minor.
This same officer attacked another young black kid in Inglewood within the last month. He's still on the force. He wasn't suspended then because the video wasn't running. I don't think he was provoked then. I don't think he was provoked this time.
Also coming forward was Alicia Williams, who says her brother Nielsen was beaten by Morse on June 23rd. She brought photos of Nielsen, who was severely wounded. He spent 5 days in the hospital for head and neck injuries. Nielsen was at an Inglewood park when Morse and other officers stopped him. They allege Nielsen attacked them and had to put him in a chokehold. Alicia says her family was never notified of his whereabouts. She discovered him later that night in Sentinella Hospital. Alicia acknowledged that not much has changed in the 11 years that have lapsed since the Rodney King beating in March of 1991, which was also caught on video.
I really hate to say this, but it's sad, but in my heart I really believe it will never change, because as long as we have people with hate within their hearts, with racism outviews, it would never change. So therefore I live my life the way I can, my family, but also we don't want people from the outside come violating us for no reason.
And the protests aren't over. Demonstrators will meet again at 10 a.m. Friday at the Inglewood Civic Center. Joining them this time will be the Reverend Al Sharpton. Jackson and his family will make a public announcement later this week. In Inglewood, I'm Peter Seymour.
Some of the nation's 77,000 tons of deadly nuclear waste could be headed through your town in the coming years. Last night, the Senate passed a plan to ship the waste to a massive underground repository at Yucca Mountain, Nevada. Opponents say the nuclear industry bought the vote with campaign contributions, and they're already filing legal challenges to the proposal. But even if they can stop the Yucca Mountain plan, the problem still remains of what to do with the nation's growing stores of dangerous radioactive material. Joshua Chaffin reports from Washington, D.C.
Nevada had vetoed a House bill authorizing the Yucca Mountain project, but the Senate intervened with a 60-39 vote. The plan is to ship the deadliest substance known to humanity over the roads and rails of 44 U.S. states. If there's an accident in shipping, Kevin Champs with the Nuclear Information and Resource Service anticipates problems.
We're talking about a mobile Chernobyl. We're talking about a nuclear catastrophe that can affect many thousands of people.
This nuclear waste is going to go by schools. It's going to go by hospitals.
California Democrat Barbara Boxer fought a losing battle on the Senate floor yesterday.
It's going to go by our children. It's going to go by our homes. It's going to go by our businesses.
The Department of Energy admits some accidents could happen in the decades it takes to ship the country's nuclear waste to Yucca Mountain. But the department says something has to be done with the waste, and they say Yucca Mountain is the best place for it. Kevin Champs says the site was only chosen because Congress didn't have the votes to put it anywhere else.
If the waste is buried there, in the end, it's going to leak into the environment, and it's going to contaminate the drinking water supply out there.
Last night, the majority in the Senate disagreed. The nuclear industry contributed $1.3 million to Senate campaigns from January last year to February this year. Alaska Republican Senator Frank Murkowski got more of that money than any other senator, and he's been a tireless champion for the Yucca Mountain proposal.
We've had about 2,700 shipments in the last 30 years. There has not been a single release of radioactivity.
Nevada has five federal lawsuits pending, but Senator Murkowski says if Congress had let the Yucca Mountain project die, nuclear power itself would be threatened. Of course, anti-nuclear activists would like nothing more. They vow to challenge every step of the licensing process. But even if Yucca's opponents are successful, the nation's nuclear waste won't just go away. Public Citizen's Lisa Gyu says the waste should be left at or near the 131 sites around the country where it lies now.
With nuclear waste so dangerous sitting still, it's only more dangerous when you put it on wheels. We need to improve the safety and security of waste storage as close as possible to where that waste was created.
Nuclear power plants continue to churn out about 20% of the nation's energy and some 200 tons of deadly radioactive waste every year. President Bush's energy plan calls for construction of new nuclear power plants. So even if the repository is completed on time and the shipments arrive on schedule, by that time there'll be the need for another Yucca Mountain. Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Last week, President Bush announced that he was cutting money from the 33 Superfund sites, including some of the nation's most polluted, because the EPA is running out of money. Other toxic cleanup sites not included on Bush's list are faced with the threat of insufficient resources. In Ithaca, New York, residents are upset about the cleanup of the highly toxic site of the former Ithaca Gun Company. Many are concerned that the EPA and the city have not effectively protected the health of those in the surrounding neighborhoods and are critical of the proposed standards for the cleanup, which they claim will leave unacceptably high levels of lead in the residential area. But all agree that the cleanup should be done before the money runs out. In this, the third of our five-part special series highlighting Superfund sites across the country, correspondent Sasha Lilly files this report from Ithaca.
Ithaca Falls is one of the most scenic spots in upstate New York, a place where people routinely go for picnics, fishing, and swimming. Yet the falls are located directly under the site of the former Ithaca Gun Company, which produced and tested guns for over 100 years until the 1980s, and which is now known to be highly contaminated with toxic chemicals, including lead at levels 500 times greater than the state standard. Walter Hang, president of Toxics Targeting, an environmental database company.
I filed a Freedom of Information request, and I basically got detailed documents showing that up to 215,000 parts per million of lead had actually been identified in this de facto city park. And I found out that Cornell University had sold the contaminated property to the city of Ithaca for a dollar, knowing full well that the extensive lead contamination was there, along with arsenic, other heavy metals, and toxic chemicals leaking right out of the ground.
The site is in many ways similar to Superfund sites on thousands of former target ranges around the country. However, it is also exceptional, not only because of its beautiful natural setting, but also its extremely residential location and the proximity of two schools within a quarter mile of the site. A number of city residents have various concerns about the cleanup of the site by the EPA, which is officially slated to start as early as this week. In particular, many are upset by what they see as the city and the EPA's unresponsiveness to their health and safety concerns. Although the toxicity has been known for the last 2 years, the Ithaca Falls area has not been fenced off, and people have continued to enter the site regularly. Neighborhood residents have not been warned about possible soil contamination in their properties, and although Fall Creek Elementary School, which is just below the site, has tested as having high levels of lead and mercury, no actions have been taken. Walter Hang.
People have been traipsing in and out of this contaminated area and been exposed to contamination that's now known to pose a health hazard for 2 years since this problem was identified.
Margarita Fabrizio is a member of the neighborhood organization Fall Creek Unleaded, which was formed by residents concerned about the cleanup. She is upset that the EPA has started demolishing structures on the Ithaca Gun Company's site, which may contain asbestos, before any public hearings and without public notification.
They've removed a number of structures already. They received, it turns out, a demolition permit back in April. The city obviously knew about that. We were not notified.
On June 20th, the EPA set up what it termed an availability session for the public to come and raise their concerns. Mike Bazile of the EPA says that criticisms that the agency does not welcome public input are incorrect.
We will take those public comments and, if need be, change our plans based on the input that we get from the public.
Bazile believes that community criticism of the EPA's concerns for resident safety are unfounded.
If there's one thing I could tell the resident in Ithaca, it's that we have a strong health and safety plan that'll protect them during all portions of the cleanup. And if at any time there is a problem with any type of contaminants that come across our air monitors, we will shut the job down immediately and discover what the problem is.
But critics like Walter Hang of Toxics Targeting are not convinced. He believes that the EPA and the City of Ithaca have not taken the necessary precautions so far to protect residents and school children, and that their proposed plan is insufficient.
Unfortunately, the work plan is completely inadequate. There are huge residential areas and schools that are immediately adjacent to the site, and they have never been tested on a comprehensive basis for lead contamination. As a result, the EPA isn't planning to clean up those areas. The EPA isn't going to clean up even areas that are known to have high levels of contamination.
Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Sasha Lilly in Ithaca.
The 14th International AIDS Conference began this week in Barcelona, Spain. The first day was marked by the many protesters who managed to drown out U.S. Health Secretary Tommy Thompson as he attempted to speak about American global AIDS programs. Dozens of people demanding more U.S. funding climbed onto the stage as Thompson tried to address the conference. Some waved placards declaring, "Wanted, Bush and Thompson for murder and neglect of people with AIDS."
You've got to make sure they give the secretary his freedom.
Today, AIDS activists from HealthGap and ACT UP Paris brought proceedings to a screeching halt, descending on the display booths of the European Union. At issue is that the US and EU spend less per capita on the global fight against AIDS than Rwanda and Uganda. As Zepa Enati of Treatment Action Campaign South Africa said, speaking at the Tommy Thompson protest, the US spends just $200 million a year on the global fight against AIDS.
We heard after 17...
September 11, that the U.S. had managed to mobilize within a day, within a matter of a few days, $14 billion to fight the war against terrorism and to support companies that had suffered through the Terrorist Act. But when the U.S. is given a chance through the Global Fund to contribute in the fight against the terrorism of AIDS that has killed more than 200,000 South Africans and more than 5 million Africans and other people in developing countries, the U.S. says we do not have resources. And this makes us raise questions about the U.S.'s commitment to humanity and about the U.S.'s true intentions.
And while the world's wealthy governments come under fire, corporations are also being targeted by protesters for their lack of action to combat AIDS. We go to the streets of Barcelona to KPFA's Davey D of Hard Knock Radio.
It's Davey D hanging out with you at Barcelona at the World AIDS Conference. And right now I'm standing in front of a huge Coca-Cola bottle. And it says, Coke neglect equals death for African workforce, AIDS treatment now. It is the result of a huge protest that took place this afternoon against Coca-Cola, and we're talking to some of the organizers. What's your name for everybody?
My name is Sharon Ann Lynch. I'm with ACT UP New York and Health Gap.
So tell us about this. Why Coca-Cola?
Why Coca-Cola at an AIDS conference? Well, we brought our 25-foot inflatable Coke bottle with the messages, Stop Medical Apartheid, Coke's neglect equals death for workers in Africa, precisely because Coke refuses to provide AIDS treatment for their workers in Africa and throughout Southeast Asia.
So, I mean, is it just Coke's responsibility? Aren't there so many other corporations and companies that are in these areas that could be just as equally guilty of not providing what they can?
Unfortunately, there are so many corporations that are not fulfilling their primary obligation, which is to provide treatment to their HIV-positive workers and their family members. One among them that we also targeted today was Anglo American, the largest mining concern in South Africa. Even by their own estimates, that corporation in South Africa has a workforce that is at least 20% HIV-positive.
But I hear Coca-Cola is one of the biggest employers in South Africa. Do you think that people might be concerned that Coke, if they get too much pressure, might take their jobs and their resources to another country and another place where they don't protest against them?
Coca-Cola is one of the most admired brands in South Africa. I was stunned to see this, but it's true. Also, Africa represents the largest growth market, meaning it's a market that's growing faster than any other. Also, Coca-Cola is in every African country but two. Coca-Cola is in Africa to make money, and their profits are enormous. They're not moving anytime soon. However, we will so quickly align their image with the fact that there are people dying needlessly unless they change their policies now.
Lastly, what should people in the States be doing? I mean, as you said, Coke is a very admired and a very, it's an all-American brand. They sponsor concerts. They, they're the beverage that is here, the official beverage that's here. So, I mean, can we realistically have an economic impact on a company that's so large?
You know, we're not calling for a boycott, but I have to tell you something. I used to drink Coca-Cola a lot, but I look around me, and every time I see their logo, I think about their vast African workforce that does not have access to medications that could keep them alive. And I myself can no longer drink Coke. As for Americans, I would ask that you contact the CEO of Coca-Cola in Atlanta, that you contact your schools, and you kick Coke off your campus, out of your schools, until they change their policies. That if you are a student, you get your university to divest. It is only through public pressure that we are going to change Coke's policies. And if we change Coke, then we go to the mining corporations. We must let these corporations know that this is not allowed.
Well, folks, this is David D. Peace, everybody.
In the West Bank town of Nablus today, residents are reporting that Israeli soldiers fired live ammunition at a group of children and teenagers who threw stones at tanks as they passed by the Askar refugee camp. This as Israeli police yesterday shut down the administration building of Al-Quds University in East Jerusalem, where leading Palestinian moderate Sari Nusseibeh serves as president. Israeli police have closed many offices in East Jerusalem that they say are used to do business illegally on behalf of the Palestinian Authority. Palestinians say the closures are trying to undermine Palestinian institutions in East Jerusalem, essentially leaving their territories lacking crucial infrastructure. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Kata Mesta is in the West Bank town of Salfit, where Palestinians and Israelis are working together to ease the hardship the Israeli occupation and curfew is bringing to Palestinian lives.
We have to be getting there before the curfew ends. And so it's a very complicated operation, and be aware of the risk.
Those instructions were given to some 400 Israeli citizens who risk prison time for entering the northwest bank town of Salfit. Under current law, it is illegal for Israeli citizens to enter the occupied territories. But these Israelis broke that law in order to guarantee the delivery of critical medical equipment to the town surrounded by the Israeli military, guarding some 20 Jewish settlements in the area. Mikado Warshavsky.
The presence of Israelis is a disturbance. They cannot shoot. They don't want to kill Israelis. They don't want to kill foreigners. They don't care to kill Palestinians.
The group is part of a joint Palestinian-Israeli partnership, and they traveled in buses from Haifa, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and Beersheba after collecting money from Palestinian villages and the streets of Tel Aviv to purchase the medical supplies. After negotiations, the military permitted the 7 buses to enter Salfit. As the buses drove through the town, Palestinians emerged from each residence, lining the streets and waving to the Israelis. Colonel Kamal Kadoumi is head of the municipality and greeted the Israelis at the 8-bed government hospital of Salfit.
We are welcoming for this group, for these people who are support the peace. And you see, we are together, we are friends. We are against the soldier who come with his guns or his bomb. And he wants to damage our cities, or he wants to kill our kids. This is we are against him. But these people, we are welcoming for them. As you see, we are friends and we can continue the life together.
Once the supplies were unloaded, Colonel Kadoumi invited the Israelis to Salfit City Hall, next to the destroyed local Palestinian police headquarters, where everyone drank sodas and mingled. Shira Kam came from Haifa and works at Musa, an advocacy center for Arabs in Israel. She said she needed to see firsthand what the military occupation is doing to Palestinians in the territories.
I'm reading the Israeli papers, and then on the other hand, there are people that I work with who say, well, this is what's happening to my family on the other side of the line, or this is what's happening that I've heard of. And there's all sorts of different sources of information that come in there that people in the Israeli public just don't hear about.
Azmi Bader is one of the founders of the Palestinian Jewish Partnership and says the membership is not deterred by the threat of prison time and will continue to enter the occupied West Bank and Gaza. In the last year, the organization has increased from 75 to 400 people.
For us, very successful. It's not just the money and the medical machine that we are bringing with us. It's the solidarity from the people in Israel, meaning the Jewish people, the Arab people, the Palestinian people that live in Israel. For us, it's to linkage between the two people that there's a next way we can resist the occupation. It's not the way, the violence way.
As the Israelis boarded their buses to leave Salfit, 9-year-old Saba yelled into the microphone. He says, peace with the Jews. At a roadblock, the Israeli military stopped the 7 buses exiting Salfit. As the soldiers conducted a head count and searched each bus for explosives, they singled out the 5 Palestinians in the group, prompting all 400 Israelis to protest. At this, they were returned to their seats and each bus allowed to pass. There were no arrests. For Free Speech Radio News in the West Bank town of Salfit, I'm Kata Mester.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.